The heat is still on, but the radio was jammed with stories. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol, hiding from the sun, Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
Irish history should be proud of Richard Martin. All animal rights law in the world and the Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, he was the driving force behind, stemmed back to this individual. Yep, very few people have heard about it.
Some people will become more patient and tolerant and change their way of life. Others will return to the old habits. That's the way life goes.
So at my mum's wake, I was just shy of my sixth birthday. And I was left, unfortunately, to greet people who were coming into the wake with my hand outstretched and a big smile on my face, to saying, "Did you hear Mammy died?"
And we'll start here on Today with Claire Byrne and Olympic medalist Sonia O'Sullivan.
So Olympics coverage begins on RT2, RT Radio 1 and the RT Player tonight, tomorrow morning at 1:30. And you'll be part of that coverage over the next couple of weeks. How do you feel about the whole thing, first of all? So many COVID issues around it. Are you glad it's finally getting started? How do you think the athletes will be coping with the restrictions?
It's great to see things getting started. And I think it's been a long time coming, but then all of a sudden it seems to have come really quickly. The last few weeks, things have really picked up a bit. And, you know, just to see the athletes traveling out there and the reports coming back from the Olympic Village and everything, it's pretty exciting to see that it's actually going to take place. And we're going to be able to watch all the Irish athletes competing.
Do you feel there's an advantage in a way to not having the crowds there, to not having the pressure of family there? Does it just mean that focus becomes more prominent for these athletes rather than worrying about what's going on around them?
I'm sure most athletes would prefer that there is crowds, but, you know, you have to deal with, you know, the situation that you're presented with. And many of the athletes will have competed, you know, in front of empty stadiums over the past 18 months or so. So they're well used to it by now. And, so they won't be thinking about that. I mean, it's not something that the athletes think about. They don't worry about who's in the stands or who's not. The main thing is that they're actually ready to go out there and prepare to compete as best they can. That's like the number one priority. Everything else is just kind of extra. And, you know, it can be a bonus or a distraction or, you know, a hindrance, you know, depending on the type of person that you are and how you like to prepare for your events.
How did you feel about it as a competitor?
I never had to think about it, really. I suppose the thing is, you would often go into an empty stadium before the competition began and it would look massive, like it really huge, you know, you'd feel so tiny inside there. And then when you went into a stadium and it was full of people, it seems much smaller. A bit more intimate. So I think that's the difference, is the perception of space around you when you're in there, that you're competing, you know, you're the small little people running around on the track. It just changes the whole perspective of things. But I think, you know, when you're watching on TV and listening to the commentary on the radio, then most people won't know the difference.
Yeah.
I think we're in for, you know, a couple of weeks of amazing competition. I think it's fantastic that there's, you know, the biggest Irish team ever, 116 athletes. There's 58 women on the team and across 19 different sports. So I'm not 100% sure, but there's a fair chance that there'll be an Irish athlete competing most days of the games. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it certainly
is. Somebody to support, you know, every day.
But you've written about how we should measure our expectations and think about where these athletes are coming from and not put all of that weight on them when we're thinking about medal prospects, because for them, being there really is the win, isn't it, for some of them?
Yes, I mean, for most athletes, I mean, it's the greatest achievement of their life to qualify for an Olympic Games. And, you know, you would never take that away from anybody. But I think everybody who goes to the Olympic Games has a different perspective on, you know, how far they're going to get in the Games, you know, if they're going to get to the final or not. But, you know, I think most athletes would want to match the performance that got them to the Games and see, you know, where they are with that performance. For some athletes, it may be their first Olympics. So, you know, being there, going out and competing as best they can is, it's a line in the sand for the future. And others will have been there before and they'll be trying to, you know, do better this time out. Mm-hmm.
You called the failure to select Rashida Adelecki to compete in the mixed relay squad as one of the worst decisions made by Irish athletics. Tell us a bit more about why you said that.
Well, I think, you know, in a way, I think that's been put to bed now. I think, you know, there was a moment there when, you know, Rashida, she's a great Irish athlete. She's a young athlete. She won the European under 20, 100 metres and 200 metres last week and created one of the most exciting races when she ran in the 4x400 relay and got Ireland right up into contention, only that she'd put in too big of an effort. And, you know, it just showed her potential as an athlete. And it's just a shame that someone so young and with such great potential won't get to experience the Olympics, you know, in a relay, in a kind of a not such a high-pressured situation, because hopefully in the future she'll be able to go out there and run in 100 metres and 200 metres individually, which is what she was trying to do mm-hmm. by running those events at the National Championships in Ireland.
Was there a logic behind it? I did see somewhere that they may have felt she was too young.
There's probably a good chance that that is why. I mean, you know, that she had a championship already this year to aim for and she was very successful in. But, you know, I think sometimes you have exceptional athletes and you have to have a bit more foresight and, you know, make decisions outside of the box, you know, because for the future of the sport. But, you know, if decisions being made and, you know, the athletes who are selected, I'm sure they will go and compete and represent Ireland, you know, as best they can. But, you know, these decisions have to be made and they're made every year. There's always someone who gets left at home that people will think should have been there.
Sonia O'Sullivan from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, Oliver Callan was talking to Peter Phillips about the curious life of Irish animal rights campaigner Humanity Dick.
Now, did you know that an Irishman was the pioneer of animal welfare laws all over the world, which stem back to this day in 1822? And his nickname was Humanity Dick. And here to tell us all about it is the founder of Tedfest, Peter Phillips. Good morning, Peter.
Morning. Morning, Oliver.
So,
There's a CV for you.
There it is. Yeah, I mean, you've given us that festival that celebrates all things Father Ted, which is very memorable. And we're all looking forward to it coming back again someday, no doubt. But you've gone on to an entirely different subject. Tell us about Humanity Dick and who he is.
Well, my life, before I went down a rabbit hole of running Ted Fest, I used to write history books. And I came across Humanity Dick on holiday in Connemara many years ago. Mm-hmm. And what intrigued me was I just read a little bit in a guidebook that all animal rights law in the world stem back to this man who pioneered animal rights in the late 1700s, early 1800s, but paradoxically was the champion duelist of Ireland. So you blow your head off if you pass him the mustard the wrong direction, but he was fighting for animal rights. And the more I delved into it, there was a very good biography written about him about 50 years beforehand. Very academic read, but beautifully researched. And I wanted to retell a story because he was a very colourful man. Mm-hmm. I mean, outside of his legacy of animal rights pioneering, and he put the first piece of animal rights legislation on the statute books. But that wasn't enough for him. He was then a man in his 60s, and with his sort of duelling mentality, he then started policing the streets of London, enforcing his own law. Then he'd pop up in court prosecuting people he'd arrested under his law so he could teach magistrates the law lesson. And he was also, from a PR spin point of view, yeah. He knew his stuff. He's the only man who called a donkey as a witness in a law court. But you mean that you know, just had music hall songs written about it. So it was a way wow. of publicising his law. He was also the driving force behind the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals.
I mean, that's an extraordinary legacy. And I mean, he was very, very clever, because obviously you can put a law in and if no one knows about it, it's not going to be enforced.
Absolutely.
And I mean, tell us about the climate in 1822 and just how people couldn't get their heads around that you had to be less cruel to animals.
Oh, it was a ridiculous notion. People were sort of mocked for it. I mean, there was a school of people who used to sort of preach that you should have. In fact, his teachers and his auntie taught him. He had his own law in Connemara.
You see, he basically owned Connemara, the Martin family.
Yeah.
And he's a rogue. He wouldn't tax tenants, but he used to live off smuggling commissions. But then he'd pop up in George and London as a figure of the establishment, as the Member of Parliament for Galway. He was a friend of the Prince Regent. So he lived these sort of parallel lives in Connemara and London. And he had his own law. He used to lock people. I don't know if you've ever been to Ballybehinch Castle, which is a wonderful hotel now. But in those days, that was his house. He lived there to evade his creditors because he put 30 miles of bog between him and his creditors. He lived his whole life in spectacular insolvency.
Yeah, because I was
but he had his own law.
I was going to say, yeah. Because when I picked up the book, first of all, I was kind of initially rolling my eyes going, well, should this guy obviously was able to do whatever he wanted because, as you say, he basically owned Connemara. But it's amazing that he was a landlord who basically didn't collect the rent.
No, that's why he was called Humanity Dick, actually. It was nothing to do with animal rights. The Prince Regent, who became George the Fourth, that was his nickname. They used to call him Humanity Dick because he didn't tax his tenants. Well, what he probably didn't realise, he was also evading the King's customs by smuggling stuff into the Connemara coastline.
And he was a big fan of Catholic emancipation.
He was quite pivotal, actually. I mean, when you delve into his life, it's very rich. The Martins were full-blown Jacobites. They were called Protestants of convenience because mm-hmm. they just wanted to keep their land. But his father was arrested en route to Culloden, and that taught him a lesson. And he instilled in his son, Richard, Humanity Dick Martin, that the way to Catholic emancipation, the way to Irish independence, wasn't revolution, wasn't rebellion, it was political. And that's what Martin fought for. And he was quite pivotal in moving Catholic emancipation forward before O'Connell took over. So he was a rich man. Plus, his wife was having an affair with Wolfe Tone. You know, the more you delve into his life, you think this you can't make this up. He's a larger-than-life character.
And Peter spoke about his duelling life.
He survived a lot of duels. He stopped duelling in his 30s or 40s. He tragically killed his cousin and best friend in a duel. There was some sort of drunken argument, and, in those days, it was a matter of honour if he felt insulted. And his cousin, James Jordan, felt insulted and challenged Martin to a duel. He didn't want to fight him. He turned up without dueling.
So that's the 19th century equivalent of a drunken text slur, except you ended up getting a bit of lead.
He winged him in the leg, thinking that's it, that's the end of it. But the man tragically died of blood poisoning a couple of days later. And Martin never fought a duel after that, which was probably very convenient for Wolfe Tone, who we found out a few weeks later was having an affair with his wife.
Right.
Tone lived with the Martins. He was a tutor to Martin's stepbrothers.
It was lucky for
him. Stepson.
Was he so interested in animal welfare?
I think it was his auntie instilled and his mother instilled that sort of notion of you don't be cruel to animals. He was in school. One of the masters in the school used to preach sermons about don't be cruel to animals. But, it was a total, it was contrary to everyday life in those days. People couldn't understand it. But he had his own law in Connemara. He used to lock people up. If you know the lake at the back of Ballybehinch Castle, there's a little island with a derelict castle. It was Grunny Wales' home at one stage back in the Middle Ages. So he used to lock people up there. He had his own law there, and after about 20 years decided to go back into Parliament, because in those days, the unified Parliament. And he was very clever the way he got it through. Because he was just mocked in Parliament, saying, this is beneath the dignity of the House to even talk about this. And what he used to do is he got people to write letters to him outlining the most awful cruelty. And he used to stand up in the House of Commons and read these letters with some sort of parliamentary privilege. And everybody used to leave the House. So he was left with about 20 people in the House who were supporting what he was doing. So he'd empty the House by reading these horrible letters out.
Yeah.
at midnight when they took the vote on it. He got his law passed.
He got the law passed and enacted and enforces it himself.
Well, the very next day after it received royal assent, which it will be the 200th anniversary, that's why we're calling the 22nd of July Martin's Day.
Martin's so Day. So are you, you're Martin's looking to Day. Celebrate this, the 200th no, anniversary looking, next year?
Next year, but I think you should call, you should, I'm saying this as a Welshman, I'm saying Irish history should be proud of Richard Martin. All animal rights law in the world and the Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, he was the driving force behind, stem back to this individual. Yeah, very few people have heard about him.
Peter Phillips talking to Oliver Callan in the morning. And on the Ray Darcy Show, Sister Stan.
Now, Sister Stan joins us in studio. Good afternoon, Sister Stan.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Now, before we get to our chat, I'll just tell people that Focus Ireland and Bord Gáis Energy are calling on businesses across Ireland to sleep out for Shine a Light on Homelessness. And that's on October 15th. And they want to get groups of people, companies, employees, you might be in a club or whatever. FocusIreland.ie have all the details. FocusIreland.ie have all the details. Shine a Light. It's an annual event, Stan,
isn't
it?
It's an annual event for the last 9 years.
Okay. How are you?
I'm very good, thank God. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Good for my age, Jerry. Yeah.
Well, when you say that, what does it mean? What
do you, I'm 82 this year.
Yeah.
And, well, sure, I'm healthy.
Yes.
Again, thank God. And I'm around, I'm active, and my head is okay.
Great. Because so, the last time we spoke on the phone, but the time before that, the last time I saw you,
yeah.
you were just coming out of
yes,
the cancer.
I was, yeah.
And you were a bit shook, as they say, down the country.
2 years ago, 2019, that was, yeah. So that whole year was kind of hard, you know, the surgeries and the radiation, all that stuff. But then I recovered really well last year, thank God. And this year, I mean, I am healthy and well and keeping going.
Great to hear.
Yeah.
About the cancer, you said that as a result of it, you're more patient, more tolerant and more mindful. If it was possible for you to be all of those things, because I would have thought that you were the most patient, most tolerant and most mindful person I know.
Oh, no.
I'm just wondering, like, because and we spoke about this on the phone before, and I'm just I'd love to hear your opinion on it. About the pandemic, because some people are saying that we're all going to become more patient, more tolerant, more mindful as a result of what we've been through over the last 18 months. What's your sense of that?
Well, I suppose some people will become more patient and tolerant and change their way of life. Others will return to the old habits. That's the way life goes. But I'm hoping that it has really stopped us all in our tracks and to remind us of why we should stop in our tracks, but also to remind us of the suffering of other people, because we all in some way have been impacted by COVID, but to some degree, to others to a great degree. I mean, for example, I would say about myself, I mean, when we had the lockdown at the very beginning and the over 70s were only allowed to walk 1 kilometre or 2 kilometres.
We're not near. I think at one stage you weren't allowed to leave your garden.
No, no. And even since there have been restrictions, but because I live in the lodge with Sheila Wall and other sisters, and we're situated just outside the main Focus housing project in Stanhope Green, and on the other side there is Grange Lodge, which is a small little hostel for young people by Focus as well. So we have people around us, like even we may not be interacting with them, we would be now, but then. But then we were right in the middle, and then we had the sanctuary at the back of us with a beautiful garden, and now we have a big field, a biodiversity field, which was planted during COVID. Yeah. It's beautiful. So, like, I really feel privileged compared to other people who are living in very small apartments, older people living alone who end up frightened to go out.
Yes, yeah.
COVID. So it's impacting people relatively, you know. So it's, I suppose it's very important we remember that and how hard it is for some people, it's really hard.
Really hard. And if you had a tough life before it, it was bound to get worse.
It is. And yeah. The families, imagine the families in bed and breakfast and hotels. No, I mean, I actually can't
imagine. You know,
none of us can, really. I mean...
So the numbers have gone down. I'm just looking at the May figures here. So 7,991 homeless 5,843 are adults and 2,148 children are still in emergency accommodation. That's right. From May.
Yes, that's right. So they have gone down.
It's down about 2,000 then, or they're over 2,000 from.
And that was due to a number of factors. One was there was a rent freeze, and then there was a ban put on evictions. And as well as that, the statutory bodies worked very closely with the voluntary sector, to deal with homeless people. Mm. That made a difference. For example, they took on Airbnbs and we were able to house some homeless people there and support them, particularly people who were at risk of COVID. So there was an all-out effort made to cooperate with each other and to help homeless people either to prevent it happening or to help people exit it.
Sister Stan from The Ray D'Arcy Show. And on Morning Ireland, reaction to Taoiseach Leo Varadkar's comments on numbers for guests to weddings.
I'd say to anyone who's planning a wedding in August, operate on the basis that'll be 50. That might change, it might change to 100, but I wouldn't plan on that basis.
That was Taoiseach Leo Varadkar speaking at Dublin Castle yesterday about COVID-19's impact on how many people can attend weddings this summer. It had been hoped that wedding reception numbers could increase from 50 to 100 next month. Tara Fay is a wedding planner and president of the Irish Wedding Association. Tara Fay, good morning.
Good morning.
What's your reaction to hearing this?
You know, I don't think it's surprising, but it's hugely upsetting for a lot of couples. I think when they heard initially that we were going to possibly move to 100 people in August, they won't have heard the caveat that it was dependent on current health advice. So a lot of them would have sent out their invitations in June for 100 people. I mean, last week, the deafening silence, I think, was what within the wedding industry, we thought that was this is never going to happen. So my phone was ringing off the hook from couples, from their parents, from siblings. None of these people I know just asking, did I have any insight? And they were calling other people within our association as well to see, did anybody know? Because they would have invited 100 people and now they don't know what to do, because a lot of people, maybe they have relatives overseas. They were obviously waiting for the 19th of July for overseas travel to open. And now they're left in the position where they don't know if it's 50, they don't know if it's 100. I think it would be easier just to come out and say it is not happening, as opposed to giving some hope. And also then people who are getting married for September, October, November, they need to know.
As a wedding planner, what have you been told?
As a planner and as somebody within the wedding industry, we have been told nothing. Nobody has ever contacted anybody in the wedding industry over the last 17 months to discuss anything as regards restrictions, as regards our thoughts in terms of anything. And the wedding industry is an incredibly busy, viable, vibrant industry in this country that contributes huge amounts to local economies and is part of tourism. And we have had absolutely no interaction with any department. I think I'm such a prolific letter writer now, I must be on a banned list within Department of Tourism and Enterprise and Employment.
Tell us about, or if you can give us an example of the kind of weddings that were planned for next month.
I mean, a wedding at the moment is not what people would think of as a traditional wedding. So at the moment, there is no live or loud music for your reception, so for dinner. So there is no first dance, for example, for couples. So unless they can be incredibly creative, like at the moment where they're having a drinks reception outside, a lot of couples will do possibly a first dance outside where they are in, you know, the open air and they are not having loud music. There's only six people to a table. So the huge, big, heavy, you know, long top tables with a full dance floor with people dancing all night is not a thing that is happening at the moment. There is a curfew for weddings. Masks have to be worn unless somebody is sitting at the table. We have the best contact tracing system for weddings because every wedding will have a table plan. So we know exactly where every single guest is sitting during the whole dinner, as opposed to, I mean, we're delighted for all of our colleagues in hospitality that they're able to potentially open next week. But a restaurant would have more than 50 people in it at any one time. A lot of the age profile of our wedding couples and wedding guests will be fully vaccinated, and none of that has been taken into account.
Tara Fay speaking to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. Then later, Claire Byrne was talking to bride-to-be Kate Gallagher.
We've spoken before on the programme.
We have.
Because you have had to postpone your wedding three times up to now. So this was the fourth attempt at doing this.
Yes, this is our fourth date now. So as you can imagine, we're coming to the end of our tether here.
And you had, I mean, clearly, as you would expect, invited 100 people, had you, to your reception in August?
Yeah, so when the numbers dropped, we kind of came to the conclusion that we were going to go with 25, and we were happy with that decision. And then it went up to 50, and we invited 50, we were happy with that. And then on the basis that we were told it was going to go up to 100, we invited 100 people, a lot of those coming from London. So people have booked flights, ferries, accommodation. And now for Leo Varadkar to say, we might have 100, but it might be 50. At this point, it's just not good enough. I mean, we're 2 weeks out now.
Well, he said, didn't he, that you should operate on the basis that it will be 50.
Yeah, but I mean, the formal announcement still hasn't been made. So I don't know whether to make those phone calls to 50 of my guests to say, I'm really sorry, but it's going to be 50 now. Or if in a week's time, he's going to turn around and say, oh, it actually is 100. So do I wait for the formal announcement or do I just make those phone calls now?
So I'm just reading what he said. The limit, according to the Taoiseach, might change to 100, but he doesn't anticipate many restrictions being lifted in the coming weeks. And he advised the couple should operate on the basis that wedding receptions will continue to be limited to 50 people. So you're saying that you just don't know whether to start uninviting people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge ask to put on couples to go on. I mean, what he said, there's no definite there. So, I mean, if we do go down to 50 and then find out in a week's time that it's actually 100 and people have cancelled flights and accommodation, I mean, it's horrendous.
Mm-hmm. Are you out of pocket already?
I can't even tell you. I mean, every time we've had to change date, we've lost suppliers, we've had to pay deposits, repay deposits, and with the hotel as well, because obviously they work on minimum numbers. So at the minute, we're going on 100. We signed a contract at 100. But if it goes down below 50, our price per head, it over doubles on the price per head. And obviously, it's not our fault. We want to have as many people as possible there. But the hotel have said that's their standpoint.
So if your numbers change from 100 to 50, do you think you'll still have to pay what you would be paying for 100?
Yes. Yeah.
Gosh, okay. That's very tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a horrible situation to be in. I mean, every day I'm waking up with just this knot in my stomach because I just don't know. I mean, I'm constantly on the phone to my mum and dad, my sister, I'm going to them saying, what should I do? And I feel terrible for them because they don't know what to tell me. But I'm looking for anyone to give me any sort of validation that this is what it's going to be. But I mean, we're not getting anything.
Kate Gallagher on Today with Claire Byrne. Now, 11 children left motherless and growing up in the middle of the Troubles in Derry. Seamus O'Reilly was talking to Oliver Callan about the success of his memoir, Did You Hear? Mammy Died.
My mother died tragically young. She died when she was 43 of breast cancer. And obviously that had a massive effect. It would have a massive effect on any family, but the circumstances, of course, were that her and my father had 11 children, mm-hmm. of whom I was the ninth. So it kind of added a sort of slightly outsized element to it. But, you know, with that came the sort of logistical problems as well as the emotional problems and everything else. And so unpicking that, unraveling that and describing that has been, well, it's been something we all do anyway. It's been something we talk to our friends about. It's something that we've grown up with and we talk amongst ourselves. So when I came to think about writing a book, it was pretty much a no-brainer that that's what it was going to be about, really.
Yeah, and tell us about the title itself and how that came about.
Yes, well, the book's title is Did You Hear Mammy Died? And the reason it has that title is because it's a direct quote from me. So at my mum's wake, I was just shy of my sixth birthday, so I wasn't really completely convinced of the permanence of death. So while everyone else was obviously very sad, and I was too, whenever I remembered to be, I was kind of left alone at one moment, wasn't being shepherded as I had been for the previous few days after the death and, you know, around the funeral and wake. And I was left, unfortunately, to greet people who were coming into the wake with my hand outstretched and a big smile on my face to saying, did you hear Mammy died? Because I just thought it was the news that you had to tell people, and maybe the solemnity of the occasion was kind of somewhat lost on me.
And obviously no one had any idea how to react to that.
No, I mean, I suppose part of it is the innocence of kids. It can actually break, it can break the tension of a thing, but I suppose it was actually just really very sad. But obviously, since then, it's become something that me and my family, we laugh about. And it was important for me to get that across as well, because, you know, that story of our childhoods wasn't, you know, Sturm und Drang and screaming and crying all the time. It was a lot of laughter, it was a lot of love, and telling those kinds of stories was the sort of thing that, you know, we've just done all of our lives. So having that humour in there was very important to me.
And just as you're getting into the story, you're about to detail, in writing that is, five distinct memories you have of your mum. But in the course of writing, you found yourself remembering more.
Yeah, that was probably one of the strangest things. It's when I was putting stuff down for the book, I mean, I knew that I had quite a bit of stuff I wanted to get in, stuff that I wanted to include, but I wasn't really sure exactly how much of my memories of my mother had survived. I knew I had about five, which in and of itself is obviously very distressing that you only have five memories of your mother, but because I was so young. And then in the course of writing the book, I sort of untethered, uncovered, you know, two or three more, which was obviously incredible. And for that, I have to thank the book, I suppose, and the publishers, because maybe I never would have done that otherwise. So I detail them. They're very mundane. I mean, I think it's something I say in the book. I remember my first taste of a banana sandwich, but I don't remember being told my mammy died. I don't remember those big sort of grandiose cinematic moments, I think, that, you know, you kind of have in the movie version where it's like, oh, she took me to the swings and all this. I remember, you know, sitting in a car on a random trip back from school. I remember her giving me a penguin bar. You know, it's very small little moments and things like that. So I want to get that across, the simplicity, the mundanity, but like the specialness of those moments.
And there's one in particular you say that has a feeling attached to it.
Yes. Well, we grew up in Derry in the 90s. My mum died in 1991. So things were still pretty hairy then and thereabouts. And one of the memories I have is when we were on a bus. I must have been about four. I think I was either being taken from school or something. And the bus came to a stop. There were soldiers there, and I think they had to basically clear the whole road because of a bomb scare. I didn't know what a bomb scare was. I didn't know what a bomb was. So I just thought this was, again, something great, something very fascinating and interesting. And I just remember the feeling attached was that tension of my mum trying not to make a big deal of it, while also me telling from her demeanour and the fact that she was gripping my hand a little bit tighter. And seeing it from a child's point of view now, as someone who has a kid, you know, it kind of brought back loads of those kinds of memories. So, yeah, that was, it was quite powerful to uncover some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's just great to have that, isn't it? And to immortalise it in many ways through putting it down in the book.
And Seamus spoke about his father, Joe.
Well, I think he gets a couple of mentions early on, but the part of the book that I really like to sort of use to introduce him is, it's a particular memory I have of his behaviour when we go shopping. He was a stickler for a bargain. He was unembarrassable when standing in front of a cashier with a slowly growing line of disaffected people behind him. And he was, and still is, he's a
he's an interesting man with a lot of very interesting qualities. So I wanted to get that across in the book because we obviously adore and worship my dad for everything he did. He's the kindest, most lovely, and most, you know, awe-inspiring guy to have done everything that he's done. But if I wrote a book that was just about those parts of his personality, it would seem a bit mawkish and insincere. So I wanted to get across the fact that he's also quite mad. So I hope he won't mind me saying that.
It's an Irish memoir, so we kind of half expect it. And he is that kind of stoic northern character, isn't he? And I love this description, which I sat up and went, yes, these are the Ulster people. This whole aversion to making a fuss.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of one of the messages of the book is, you know, in writing this, and obviously I wanted it to be funny. I wanted it to get across the fact that this was, you know, a lived experience that was, you know, rounded. It wasn't just a complete misery. It wasn't some sort of, you know, life of deprivation as much as it was. There was really very tough stuff about it. But there was an awful lot of, you know, humour and, you know, just getting on with it, you know. Yeah. And my dad is probably the patron saint of just getting on with it. Mm-hmm. You know, we occasionally would ask him, probably more than parents or children really should ask their parents. We'd say, Daddy, how did you do this? How did you have 11 kids? Especially now that we have kids ourselves, you know, a lot of us, he'll just get a random phone call, you know, at you know, 4 p.m. on some random Tuesday when, you know, there's puke all over the floor and there's a Lego embedded in your ankle. You'll call him up and say, I'm so sorry. How did you do this? You know, how did you have 11 kids? And his answer is always the same. He says, you know, which of these will I give back?
Yeah.
Which is very sweet, but it's, we also then do immediately start suggesting candidates. So that probably...
At one stage, he had several daughters, all in their teenage years at the same time.
I think in 1999 to 2000, it was six teenage daughters at once. I had six teenage sisters. I mean, you could not use the bathroom without a 2-week appointment.
Okay, right, okay.
There was a lot of slamming of doors, I seem to remember. You know, my own memory of it is thankfully quite foggy. But, you know, and my dad, of course, wouldn't be necessarily, as much as he's a very loving, incredibly open, you know, open-hearted and generous guy who's also very in touch with his feelings and, you know, does tell us he loves us and brought us up to believe that, you know, loving and being loved is the best of things. You know, he's not a stern kind of granite kind of guy. But at the same time, he's a man in his mid-40s with 60-ish daughters at once. And it's one of the things when I started writing it, I was like doing the sums. I was like, that can't be right. And then I did the sums and I was like, oh my God, how on earth this happened? So, I mean, if people hear the story and think it sounds unbelievable, well, just, you know, comfort yourself with the thought that even I don't remember or can't understand just how exactly he did it or, you know, what it was even like.
Seamus O'Reilly talking to Oliver Callan in the morning. Now, have you been trying to buy a barbecue or some garden furniture only to find the shelves bare? Well, on Morning Ireland, Louise Byrne was looking at the items that are selling like hotcakes. Garrett Michael is a retail manager for Archers in Mayo.
You run a home improvement shop, Archers, in Ballina, County Mayo. Garrett, is there a set of rotten furniture left in all the land these days?
Just about, Louise. The very bare bones of it. Well, just to qualify it, it's a builder's merchant's hardware garden centre, and I'm one of a team of people that are running it. And we have seen unprecedented demand all this year for all things outdoor, be they leisure as in furniture, barbecues, but also different equipment for people to make their gardens look as good as possible.
It's very difficult to get furniture in particular, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. We saw this year a quicker run on items. I suppose the whole scenario, lockdown and the scenario of the last year has changed the landscape. So once the first bit of weather came this year, everyone was in as quick as possible to buy what they could. And normal years, we would be able to replenish stocks, but the supply chains have been so fractured this last year that it just has been harder. So we've had more disappointed customers, but we've had plenty of happy customers too.
I was one of those annoying people who bought a barbecue before Easter, which felt, I mean, it felt a bit insane at the time looking at my barbecue in temperatures of 8 or 9 degrees. But, you know, I'm glad of it now. You think customers are disappointed. What's very difficult to get? What's just about on your shelves still?
It's pretty much across the board, but I suppose what we were fortunate, we tried to increase quantities of what we knew people would look for. So some items we still have barbecue equipment, small amounts of garden seating, and we try as much as possible to. There's such a collection of stuff out there these days to get a good blend of quality and price. So things like Weber are a great brand of barbecue. I'm not sure we would, as much as possible, try to go along with them. And then there's another Karcher. They do power washers. So it's not so much the leisure, but there's plenty of maybe more so the male customer that like to come in and buy themselves an electric power washer, and they can take off around the house and do serious amounts of cleaning down of everything they can find.
There's an element as well, I'm sure, of we've all been looking at the same four walls for so long now that people are starting to paint those walls a lot. Tell me about paint sales.
Has been huge. Yeah, last year specifically, really, we saw that it took off. And I suppose the weather coincided with lockdown last year. And what could people do? Only they could paint. So, yeah, that was huge. It has continued. The weather hasn't played ball as much this year, obviously, and more so in the west of Ireland. We're bound by what the weather does to us. So it's probably too hot at the moment for painting, but it has been huge. And I think what a lot of people have discovered is they're appreciating their homes and their gardens over the last year. As we all know, we've had to spend more time in them. So we see a bit of a growth in that. And what we see is a lot of the younger generation getting involved in doing jobs in their homes and gardens.
Then Tina McCormack of Storm in a Teacup Ice Cream Shops.
Can you paint a picture for us? Your shop is right beside the beach in Skerries. I'd say there's queues all day on days like today.
Well, yeah, luckily. The little shop in Skerries, it was a fisherman's hut, so it's tiny, but it's in the most beautiful place. Skerries Harbour on one side, and then on the other side we have a beautiful little horseshoe shaped beach, very safe for the children. So it's a lovely place to come on in this beautiful weather that we've been having.
Did going for ice cream sort of replace going for a pint for a while there during lockdown as a social activity?
It probably did. We do both on Skerries Harbour and I'm sure most towns are the same. Yeah, but the ice cream, of course, is a real family thing. So you can bring the whole family down to us.
And you have a big business. You employ 50 staff there across the Storm and a Teacups. Has the two summers of staycations helped with the expansion there of your business?
I think it has. The whole COVID thing obviously was hard, but now we're open. It's fabulous. I couldn't complain. The people are lovely. The children are lovely. It's a great little business to be in. And it's a happy little business to be in. Everybody that comes, it's a nice little treat. A family can still get a treat for a tenner for the whole family. No complaints. It's really lovely at the moment.
And then Conor Hegarty of Mountain Forge Escape Glamping Site in Cork has had a very busy time of it.
It's been unbelievable, to be honest. It's mind-blowing what's after happening. I opened it last year in July. We provide camper vans, tents. We have our own special dome that sleeps two adults and two kids. And we have a pod which sleeps two adults and two kids. It's walking distance from a playground, private walkway down to the playground. It has five beaches within 5 minute drive from the site. It has a 3 minute drive to the mountain house, food and rescue pub and restaurant.
So and Connor, have you been affected by the Connor? Can I ask? Have you been affected by, you know, we can travel internationally now, but have people kept their bookings, or are some people going to the airports now instead?
No, we haven't seen. It's all Irish coming here to the campsite. I haven't experienced any of the European travellers at all yet, with the camper vans and stuff. But no, it's all been mainly Cork, a lot of local Clonakilty, Ballineen, Barry Row, all the local families are coming out here just tinting because it's so close, and the new families coming from Cork, coming down, and the kids go back up to training, and it's only 45 minutes away, and they come down for a week, some staying for 2 weeks. The weather at the moment has been unbelievable, so it's people are coming, staying for last weekend, they just stayed for two nights, and then they started staying on and staying on and staying on, so it's really down to the weather as being massive, because weekends have been full up, but during the week has been, it can be up or down, it depends on the weather with the tinting.
Conor Hegarty talking to Louise Byrne on Morning Ireland. And on Today with Claire Byrne, a tragic story about the loss of a young father. Catherine Duggan was talking about her husband Liam's death.
In 2017, father of two Liam Duggan died from septicemia. Last week, 4 years after his death, University Hospital Kerry apologised and acknowledged the deficit of care which resulted in his passing. Catherine, Liam's widow, joins me this morning along with her solicitor, Rachel O'Shaughnessy. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you very much for being with us, and Catherine, particularly to you. We're very grateful to you for talking to us. Can we start with you just telling us a little bit about Liam, about your husband? He, we know, was a pro golfer and very much a family man, a devoted father to your two very young children at the time. But tell us a little bit more about your husband, the man you knew and loved.
Liam was kind and caring. He had two beautiful children, as you know, at this stage, Jack and Amelia. Amelia was only 13 months when all this kicked off. Absolutely fabulous father, wonderful partner, would do anything for me, anything for the kids. It took a long time for thinking with Jack, you know, waiting for daddy to come home playing cars with him. So it just hard to lose all that.
Mm-hmm. And he was obviously fit and healthy. I mean, he was a pro golfer, so it was his job.
He was actually an advanced PGA pro golfer. He worked hard for that, the advanced on his qualifications. So yeah, worked very hard, brilliant golfer, and he worked with kids, which he loved. So he could teach golf to maybe up to 180 kids a day.
And his thing was, what he loved was, wasn't it, coming home to you and to the children?
Coming home, yes, yes. That's what he wanted. That's what he loved, come home, switch off after his busy day and spend time with us.
So then can we go back to March of 2017, Catherine, and when Liam yes. began to feel unwell. Just take us through what happened that day.
I think we went for a drive that morning. We came back and we had a very late lunch. It was he cooked a leg of lamb. He was the cook in the house. We ate dinner, and that evening he started to feel unwell. Now, we'd all eaten the same thing, so it wasn't anything like that. He just had his tummy was upset, and he started to be sick late into the evening. Now, I didn't take a whole lot of notice at the start because Jack had an upset tummy a few days earlier. So I just thought they had a little bug that they both got, but he just got sicker and sicker. And I think he called South Dock at some unearthly hour of the morning. And the doctor said, look, if he's not better by 6 or 7 a.m., we need to get him into the hospital to give him fluids because he's going to be severely dehydrated.
Okay, so at some point, obviously, you took a decision that you needed an ambulance.
Yes, on the advice of South Dock, because I just thought it was a stomach bug that it was bad. It was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. And so he was admitted then, Catherine, at that point, was he?
He was admitted at that point. So he was gone in the ambulance, and I was here at home with a three-year-old and a 13-month-old. Wondering what the heck do I do now? So I call my mom, who jumped in the car, who's from Abbeyfield, who's back here within 20 minutes to me, so I could follow him in.
Okay, so you went into the hospital then. So you were following.
I went into the hospital.
Following what was going on and what was happening to him.
Yeah, so I was able to get back to the room then in ER where he was and see what was going on. And he was sitting on at the end of a bed and he was still being sick. Then he was sent to ICU, and he was in ICU for maybe two weeks. Yeah.
And he was released then on the 3rd of April in that year?
Yes, yes. I think it was the 3rd of April, yeah.
Was he well at that point? You know, when he came home, how did you think he was?
No, the doctor inside had said, look, you're after being through the ringer. You need a good 2 to 3 months to get your energy levels back up. And I think they gave him a box of Panadol and something else for his tummy leaving there and said he'd be fine. And he did have a follow-up appointment within that period as well. But he wasn't okay. He was in bed or on the couch. He literally couldn't move. He couldn't eat. He wasn't okay.
And how long after he was discharged and sent home did you know something really isn't right here?
I gave it about 2 days. And then on day three, I was going, this just doesn't seem right at all. I think it was on day four or five, then we had to get him back into the hospital. Now, we did go back into Tralee Hospital and they admitted him again straight away.
And did you know at this point what was wrong? Did you have any indication how serious it was?
No, I still didn't. I was in and out him for a couple of more days, maybe one or two more days. They did a couple of scopes on him. I think on the third scope, they sent me home. They said, look, it's late in the evening. We're going to do this. And you're going to stand in the hallway, go home. And I said, perfect. Look, I'll go home to the kids and put them into bed. I'll be back in. So I think I got a call from a nurse around 6:45 p.m. that evening and said they had to put Liam into an induced coma as he was agitated. So I questioned that and I said, I'm going to be right in. Give me a few minutes to get there. So Mom was on the way back. As soon as she arrived, I got another phone call to come in immediately that something had gone wrong.
And that was that when they said mentioned kidney failure to you?
That's when they mentioned the bowel. The kidneys weren't mentioned until at least a day later. That was his bowel, that he needed emergency bowel surgery.
And Liam then had to be moved to Cork University Hospital.
The people in the ambulance, I think it was some kind of a special ambulance. I can't remember the name of it now, but they had to call in a special ambulance to move him. They just said, look, it's very unlikely he'll make Cork. If you see us pulled in at the side of the road, pull in after us.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
But he did make it to Cork.
He made it to Cork. He did. He made it to Cork. And we got into ICU in Cork and I was called aside again. And they told me that there was two choices because he was gone. They could let him go or they could absolutely pump him and do whatever they could and try throw everything at him to see if they could get him back. And they did that for 3 weeks and it didn't work.
So you made that decision to try to do everything that you could to try and and keep him alive.
Because I thought I'd feel guilty after if we didn't at least throw everything at it.
Mm-hmm. And was it 3 weeks or 3 days that he was in?
No, it was 3 weeks. Three weeks. So myself and Dad stayed below in Cork for 3 weeks.
And all the time you have your two, babies really, one and three home.
Yeah, at home with my mom for 3 weeks.
Did you did you manage to get them in to see him?
No, it wasn't. I think they were too young. I didn't think it was suitable. He was not himself lying in that bed. I think they'd have been traumatised.
Mm-hmm.
So I made the decision not to.
Not to, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there came the time when you had to say your goodbyes.
Yeah. They called us in the evening of the 9th of May and said, look, we can't do anything else. So they had to withdraw treatment.
Like you talk about it even now being all a blur. I can imagine that it's very difficult to even revisit that time.
It's not the easiest.
Yeah. How have the children been?
The children have been okay. They're young, so they are resilient. Amelia was so young. She doesn't remember. She doesn't remember Liam. But she does have all Jack's memories and she's convinced they're horrors. So if you ask her, she remembers everything. But it was poor Jack that took the work, really. He was traumatised after it, absolutely traumatised.
And Catherine spoke about the legal action.
Coming now to the legal action, Catherine, did you foresee at the time, this is back in 2017, that it was going to take 4 years? Or is that when you embarked on it? Was it soon after Liam's death?
It was very soon after Liam's death because I knew something was wrong and I thought the best course of action to take was get on it immediately because I had a little bit of fire in me too at that stage. I was so mad and upset because I knew it shouldn't have happened and I knew that in my heart it shouldn't have happened. So I went into Rachel in Limerick and we got it moving straight away. We jumped in, we got medical experts from the UK to review Liam's files and see what had happened.
Mm-hmm. But it took the 4 years to get to where you are today.
Yes. Now, when I started, I didn't know how long it was going to take. It wasn't even a factor in what I was doing. I think I just wanted to know that I was right, that there was something wrong. That was the main thing. Time hadn't even come into it. But 4 years later, it was a long road. Mm-hmm.
What was the road like? What was the road like, Catherine, for you?
Very bumpy at times, very bumpy. Good days and bad days. I mean, you're reliving the whole thing every time someone wants to talk to you about it. There's no closure. There's no peace. So it took a long time to get here.
I'm struck by something you said there earlier, that you felt angry. And, you know, you're somebody who's also trying to grieve losing the love of your life, the father of your children, but you're also dealing with the anger as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was very angry. Very angry. I knew there was something wrong. I knew from that phone call I got that evening that there was something wrong, that something wasn't done right.
Does it make it very hard to grieve, though, when you're dealing with all of that?
Oh, it does, of course. It does, because I think the grief gets pushed aside and you've got to find out the truth. And that's what you're focused on. You're focused on that something shouldn't have happened and why did it happen. And you're not focused on the grief.
And Claire read out some of the inquest's findings.
The inquest into Liam's death, the cause was given as multiple organ failure due to septic shock due to colitis, and a verdict of natural causes was recorded at that time. Would you like to see that inquest reopened or a whole new inquest being held?
I don't think it'll make a difference at this stage. I do think they gave the wrong verdict. I definitely think the verdict was wrong, but I don't think it's going to change anything now. They have given a letter of apology. I don't think it's going to change anything at this stage, but maybe it might. They should really just change the way they do things, because I think it's an awful ordeal to put a family through. Mm-hmm. An inquest like that, it's not right.
Well, Catherine, as I said, we have your solicitor, Rachel O'Shaughnessy, with us. Rachel, thank you very much for joining us. And to take you back to when you first met Catherine, at a time when she was going through so much grief and hurt and anger and shock. But clearly she was very determined to get answers too at that time, right from the start.
Absolutely. I met Catherine when she was recently widowed. So Liam would have died in the May, and the inquest was scheduled for the August. And Catherine came to meet us because she felt like something just didn't add up. But she didn't have any answers to these questions. Nobody in the hospital seemed to go through anything with her or suggest that they would even look into things further. Essentially, her husband, who had been healthy, had an upset stomach, and 2 months or so later, he'd passed away. So Catherine very much wanted answers, but unfortunately, although in one way it's good to have an inquest quickly, in another way you don't have the chance to arm yourself, because even if you have legal representation, a medical matter can be so complex that you need to have all the records and you need to have expert opinion to be able to ask the right questions. And whilst an inquest doesn't apportion any civil or criminal liability, it certainly should be able to answer certain questions for a family like Catherine's. And unfortunately, it was a difficult process, because we came out of that inquest not really any the wiser, and Catherine's still very frustrated as to what happened to her husband and why he wasn't there. And it's a very costly process as well. You do most of the time have to go to the UK, because doctors in Ireland won't criticise a colleague.
Solicitor Rachel O'Shaughnessy and Catherine Duggan from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.